Hey, Science Friday listeners. This is Jim DeRogatis here with Greg Kot from Sound Opinions. You know, the dictionary defines science as the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural worlds through observation and experimentation.
Well, we define music as the celebration of that world. And every week on Sound Opinions, consider us your personal guides, your professors into all things rock and roll. Whether that's debating the latest controversial Kanye West record or having up-and-coming bands like Parquet Courts perform live in our studio. And there's even the occasional foray into science with such luminaries as Oliver Sacks.
We bring you all of that good stuff for free every week on public radio stations and via podcast. Check us out at soundopinions.org.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. If you had to size up the animal kingdom, what would you say is the fiercest weapon? Maybe the sharp claws of the grizzly bear or the impressive antlers of a 16-point buck? Before you place your bets, have you considered the oversized claw of the fiddler crab that can weigh half as much as the entire animal? Or the jaw of the trap ant that can close at 143 miles per hour? My next guest studies why these weapons have evolved to such extremes. He says that if you're looking for fierce competitors, you should consider the lowly dung beetle. Doug Emlyn is the author of the new book, Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. He's also a professor in biology at the University of Montana in Missoula. He joins us from the studios of Montana Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you can read an excerpt of the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/animalweapons. And if you have any questions about animal weaponry, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So first of all, what are some of the conditions that push these weapons that you write about in the book to become so extreme?
Well, this is a question that actually stumped us for a number of years. I confess I've spent a lot of my life studying crazy weapons in beetles. And as you said, the dung beetles are sort of the unheralded champions that most of us take for granted. But it turned out that when you start looking across different groups of animals, from things like caribou to fiddler crabs or the dung beetles, the same set of conditions tends to tip the balance in favor of an arms race, a circumstance where all of a sudden, like an alignment of the stars, conditions set up so that bigger weapons perform quite a bit better than smaller weapons, and these populations can start getting bigger and bigger and bigger weapons fast. And the crucial missing link that took so long for us to stumble on is actually the nature of the fight itself. The fights have to play out as predictable duels, one-on-one battles of strength. In those kinds of contexts, it's the male that's usually bigger and in better condition and almost always with the bigger weapons that's the male that wins.
And you describe a whole variety of these weapons, including some I'd never even heard of. Maybe you could pick out a few of your favorites, the weapons that just make you go, wow, I can't believe that that's on an animal.
So this is part of the fun of this job, if you will. I mean, I've been impressed with some of the monstrous weapons that we've all heard of, like mastodon tusks, or I was just in an establishment in Missoula last night with an incredible caribou bull mounted on the wall, and the antlers on these things are incredible. But when you look at the small things, like the dung beetles, you might be astounded by the weapons that they have. So sometimes you have to get down on your hands and knees and you have to look at these things close because the beetles themselves might be much smaller than a caribou or a mastodon. But relative to their body size, these weapons are enormous. And so there are species with pairs of curving horns that arc up and over the back of a beetle coming from the back of the male's head and extending all the way over the rest of the male and beyond the end of his body. And some of these horns are branched or forked. There are species with a huge horn that comes forward from between the shoulder blades like a jousting spear that sticks in front of the animal like a little pencil in front of their bodies. And these jousting spears can be longer than the rest of the beetle so that you look at these things and they look like they should tip over.
But we think about these dung beetles, you know, picking up a piece of dung and then rolling it as a ball away. What do you need all these horns and spears for?
It's a great question. And in fact, that was part of the mystery. You don't. So when you look at dung beetles, that was why these turned out to be such a pivotal group of animals, for me at least, trying to solve this riddle of why only some species have the weapons. Because if you go someplace like East Africa, where you can in fact see hundreds and hundreds of these beetles pushing their balls across the dirt, none of them have the weapons. And yet you go to the same place, you can even go to the same pile of dung, push it aside, and underneath the dung, there will be all these tunnels, burrows extending down into the soil beneath the dung. And most of us don't notice these things because they're not obvious. You see the ones on the surface rolling the balls. The ball rolling species never have these weapons. The fights are loose tangles and scrambles, and they're not predictable, consistent contests of strength. But the beetles that fight underground in the tunnels, that makes all the difference. Inside the tunnels, the males will line up and face each other one at a time. You can't have 10 rivals piling onto a male at one time in a tunnel because only one can fit in the entrance at a time, and it has to approach face to face. And so inside these tunnels, you get a whole different suite of dung beetle species, and these guys fight in predictable pushing matches of strength. And most of the beetles with the crazy weapons are these guys that fight inside the burrows in duels underground.
So they're fighting one-on-one in these burrows, and the question is, are they fighting with deadly attacks, or are they just kind of like a couple of kids in the schoolyard pushing each other so that the girls will take a look?
So oddly enough, it's more like the latter. These things look fierce, and they are impressive by any standards, but these things are built like tanks. So most of the time with the dung beetles, they don't actually fatally injure each other. They're pushing and prying. These are contests of strength. And the smaller weapons, the beetle with the smaller weapons gets pushed out of the burrow and they leave. They lose in the reproductive battle, so to speak. They fail to acquire access to the female, but it doesn't mean they get stabbed or killed in the process. Now, that's not true necessarily across all of the animals with big weapons. So you see injuries in males all the time, in moose or in elk or deer, and even in other beetles like the rhinoceros beetles. They look like tanks, but the armor isn't quite as thick, so to speak. And so you find rhinoceros beetle males with puncture wounds and holes in the sides of their cuticle or their exoskeleton where they've been stabbed or crushed from battles with rival males. But in the dung beetles, they're almost indestructible. We almost never see, you know, mortal injuries, so to speak, arising from the fights.
We're talking with Professor Doug Emlin, whose book is Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. And we've been talking about dung beetles, which I know you're very fond of. What are some of the mammal weapons that you write about that you're particularly taken with?
Well, so I've spent most of my life studying the type of weapon that crops up in males. So these are called sexually selected weapons, and they're used in battles among rival males over access to females. But you ask about favorites. I have to say there's sort of another category of extreme weapons, and it was one for years I just sort of pushed aside academically because they didn't fit into the same mold, and they were obviously evolving under different types of circumstances and for different reasons. But it turns out some predators have really spectacular weapons too. And it's not an accident. It's not any old predator. It's predators that don't have to run fast or swim fast or fly fast to overtake their prey. Predators that lurk and wait in ambush and pounce on prey or reach out and snatch prey as they come by, these predators often have really big, impressive, clunky, awkward weapons. And I actually brought my favorite example with me. I have it sitting on my lap in the studio. I'm holding a cast of a saber-toothed cat skull.
Wow.
And the weapons on these guys are stunning. I'm looking at a pair of 7-inch long canine teeth that I absolutely would not want puncturing the back of my skull or my neck.
So, and there's a picture of a saber-toothed cat on the cover of your book, and you look at this and you say, okay, those two front teeth have got to be really good for something, but how does it, you know, eat what it catches? It seems as though it's good at something, but probably really poor at something else.
They were really poor at everything else. So reconstructions of their body shape suggest that these things were stocky and squat. They could never have run fast. So these are not cheetahs with big teeth. They were not chasing down prey. And the best estimates these days are that these guys hung out on tree branches and they would drop down onto unsuspecting prey like lumbering juvenile mammoths. And the fangs, the canines, were very good at killing large prey. You could plunge them into the back of the neck of say, a juvenile mastodon and kill it on the spot. But these poor animals had to carry these teeth around all the time. Their faces are squashed back so that their head is tilted backwards permanently, and their lower jaws had to unhinge completely, like releasing the bottom plate on a stapler, in order to get their lower jaw out of the way so that they could plunge these teeth into their prey. And then even when they get their prey, they couldn't eat easily because the big teeth got in the way. And so it looks like these guys actually had to gnaw at these carcasses and eat through the sides of their mouths in order to get around these ridiculous, awkward teeth.
Well, and it's one of the things you write about a lot in the book is the cost to these animals of having these really extreme weapons, right? The beetles that have such ornate headpieces that they've got really, really tiny eyes, or you know, a moose that has so much weight on top of its head that it really has to worry about carrying it around all day. I mean, what happens over time to these animals that have to deal with these weapons that they've developed that are just so ungainly?
It turns out I now think that these costs are a big part of the story in a lot of the sort of the arms races and the histories of the evolution of the weapons in these species, because as they get big, as you mentioned, they do in fact get very, very expensive. And so there are beautiful studies of the price that a male, you know, ungulate like an elk or a moose would pay for producing the antlers. And they actually have to leach crucial minerals out of their skeletons and shunt them into the antlers in order to build enough bone to produce these structures. And so these males are investing almost as much in their weapons as a female would invest in raising two calves to weaning. And in the beetles that we look at, like you say, sometimes they have stunted eyes. Sometimes the price is even worse than that. There are some species where the males with the big weapons actually have stunted testes and smaller genitalia. So there's a pretty hefty price these males pay. But the price keeps these things honest. And for these weapons that are used by males in these battles over access to females, the weapons, as they get big and as they get expensive, they become honest signals. And they end up starting to function for deterrence. And so you find as these weapons get bigger, males begin to assess rival males without actually lunging into battle. They can size up the weapons of their opponent and get an awful lot of accurate, honest information about whether that opponent's likely to clobber them or not. Yeah. And most fights end up stopping before they actually start. So there's this bizarre paradox that arises that the species with the biggest weapons end up fighting the least frequently. Because almost all of the battles, so to speak, battles in quotes, end up resolving themselves before they escalate into dangerous battle, because literally sizing up the weapons side by side is enough to resolve it. So the fact that these are costly makes them honest, and the fact that they're honest and huge makes them useful signals. And so you end up getting deterrence as an interesting sort of step along the way in these arms races in animals. And it all comes from those costs.
You write about at least one bird species, the jacana, where the females are actually the ones that fight with these weapons.
These are a great sort of exception that proves the rule for those of us biologists studying things like animal behavior, because normally what you find, again, this is a normal, sort of a broad sweeping generalization, is that in many, many animal species, females invest substantially more than the males do in the offspring. And because they invest so much in offspring, it takes them a long time between reproductive events. Whereas males, usually, you know, they can transfer sperm in a few minutes, a couple hours later, they're technically, physiologically, they're able to turn around and breed again. So if you were to look at a lot of animal species out there and go count, you know, head count, how many males, how many females, you'd find most of the time there's about a 50-50 ratio. But if you were to ask instead how many of those individuals out there are able to breed right now, you'd find that all the males are ready to go. But actually, a lot of the females are not. They're committed to existing reproductive events, and they're not physiologically receptive. And so you end up having this asymmetry with lots of males out there ready to breed and very few females. And that's the backdrop for these battles. The jacanas are incredible because they're backwards. Everything is turned on its head. Huh. And in the jacanas, the males take care of the young. The males invest the most time in each reproductive event. So the males end up becoming sort of a limiting resource. And there are a lot more females out there running around ready to go, ready to breed, than there are males. And so the jacanas are a strongly sexually selected species. But because of this flip-flop, if you will, and who's doing the investing, the females fight with females over access to males. And so they have the bigger weapons. They've got these spurs on their wings that they use in fights. And the jacana females are bigger than the males. They're more aggressive than the males.
Yeah.
And they've got the relatively larger weapons.
We're talking with Doug Emlyn, who's the author of Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I want to go to a phone call here. Maya is calling from Chicago. And Maya, what's your question?
Hi, this is so fascinating. I just love it. Thank you guys for taking my call. I was just thinking about piranhas that came to mind as a child. I remember watching public television and seeing them devour a human or something, and it was like really scary. Yet I had always wondered, how in the world could such small fish do so much damage with those teeth? And then I started to think about the comparison of a shark, where we're hearing they're biting, you know, legs off and stuff like that, but didn't seem to do as much damage so quickly as a piranha. And I just thought maybe you could discuss a little bit of both of these species.
Well, I know, Doug, you've had some, and thank you, Maya, you've had some experience
yes.
with piranhas.
I was going to say I'd be delighted to, because piranhas are one of those species that's personally near and dear to me, because I had an opportunity with a buddy of mine years ago to swim in waters that we knew were piranha infested because we'd actually fished for them with cubes of meat beforehand. Piranhas are incredible. And they also, again, in terms of how these weapons evolve and why you get big weapons, there are these two categories again. They're the ones that are used by males in battles over access to females. And then there are the weapons that are used by predators for hunting or catching or overtaking prey. And so the piranhas are an example of this latter type, where they're used for capture and overtaking of prey. They're not a male weapon that they use to fight over access to females. And when you think about most types of fish predators, normally what they do is they swim fast and they have to overtake and catch their prey. So they have to be streamlined. And usually most of these fish predators open their mouths and they swallow their prey whole. So if you're going to catch big prey, you need to have big mouths and big jaws and big teeth. But if you have too big a jaw, it slows you down. It drags through the water. And if it slows you down too much, the predator can't catch the prey. So most of the predatory fish don't have really crazy teeth. You find neat exceptions. And again, they tend to be things like ambush predators. So the most spectacular jaws in sort of aquatic predators are the deep sea viper fish and the fangtooth and these deep, crazy things. Everybody knows them from Finding Nemo. But you have these fish that are essentially a mouth with a tail. And they're ambush predators. They use lures, dangling globs of light or things like that to draw the prey to them. They don't have to swim fast and overtake prey. And because they don't have to move fast, that constraint on weapon size is relaxed and you start getting bigger and bigger teeth and bigger jaws because you can catch bigger and bigger prey. So the piranha are similar to that in the sense that they don't overtake live prey. Piranha get a bad name, and they were scary, and I was scared when I was swimming with the piranha. But most of the time, they don't kill live things like people walking or swimming in the water. They go for dead animals. And most of the cases where piranhas have been chalked up as guilty of destroying, say, for example, a human, they find out afterwards that it was a corpse that was already dead, and the piranhas are scavengers, and they come in and clean up on that. And since they're feeding on things that aren't moving, they're dead, they don't have to swim fast. And so piranha are able to take hunks. They don't swallow their prey whole. They take chunks of meat off of their food, which is why they freak us out so much, because none of us want to be stripped to the bone by these things. But they don't have to overtake prey. So that constraint is relaxed in piranhas in the same way that it is in things like a saber-toothed cat. That has allowed the teeth and the jaws to get pretty spectacular.
One of the things that I will say that I learned from your book is that piranhas, to you, actually tasted pretty good, which I think makes us all feel a little bit better.
To this day, it's the best tasting fish I've ever had.
Doug Emlin is the author of a new book called Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. He's a professor in biology at the University of Montana in Missoula. You can see illustrations of these weapons and read an excerpt from the book at our website, sciencefriday.com/animalweapons. Thanks so much, Doug. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.